Good. I mean, it's good afternoon and it's pretty sunny in the beautiful city of Abu Dhabi. So for all of you who have been listening to the news about the rain in the UAE, I'd like to tell you that I can officially confirm there's not a cloud in sight at the moment. We've been seeing a lot of videos. We've been seeing a lot of damage that happened. And of course, travel has been pretty affected. Flights, schedules, tourists stuck in different places. But that's a whole different story again. I think, you know, we've just sort of woken up to the fact what weather can do and how little control we actually have on weather-related events. So I think that's a rude awakening for all of us, but I think it's what we've been seeing in so many different parts of the world. And whoever thought you would have rain in the desert, we've got about a year and a half's worth of rain in less than a day. So
right.
I was joking with someone on a phone call just now that I hope you practices scuba diving because he does a lot of scuba diving. He said, yes, David, wherever you go, you know, my scuba diving skills have come in pretty handy. But seriously speaking, there's been a lot of damage. And I think the cleanup activity will take quite some time, you know, before things come back to normal. But anyway, we are great to have a very well-known figure on this podcast, Rafat Ali. And if you don't mind, Rafat, I'll just read your title on your LinkedIn, which is the CEO and founder of Skip. But this is what I like: a perpetually exhausted dad of two hyperactive boys. So I've got grown-up kids, and
lucky you.
Yeah, I mean, my wife reminds me how lucky I am. But that aside, I would like you, for those who perhaps don't know you, I'm sure most people know you, but a quick intro about yourself, what keeps you going, what keeps you, a little bit about Skift as well, you know?
Yeah. Well, thank you, David, and thank you, Alex, and thank you for having me on this. Just so happens that you read my bio, and I just came off a bruising 45 minutes of trying to get the kids off to school. In my morning here, I'm based here in New York. So Skift, my background, let me start with Skift. Skift is a business information company focused on the business of travel. So we do news, research, conferences, marketing services, now advisory services, since we bought an advisory company last year, in the business of travel. So global company used to be based in New York. We used to have a physical office in London and Singapore pre-COVID, and then we went virtual completely as part of the pandemic and are now permanently remote as a company. We're about 80, almost 90 people based in 15 different countries now. As of a couple of weeks ago, we hired somebody in Panama, so that was our 15th country that we hired people in. But our hubs are really US, New York, London, and India in general are our hubs in terms of where a good portion of people are based. And this is our 12th year of operation. And I would humbly say, obviously, as the founder and CEO, that we've become one of the most, if not the most, influential media sources in the global travel industry. And I think the proposition that we had when we were starting, which is let's cut across different parts of the travel industry and give a holistic view of where the future of the present and the future of travel is going, has been borne out. And obviously, since then, we've gone deeper into different parts of the travel industry. We've done acquisitions in different parts, airlines and hotels and meetings industry, and this advisory company we bought, and we keep looking at different other opportunities as well as we grow. So that's us. This is my second company. I built and sold a previous media company, was not in the travel industry. So my life has been a computer engineer turned journalist turned entrepreneur. So usually people don't, from computer engineering, don't go into journalism. Probably the opposite does happen. People, like a lot of journalists, learn coding these days, etc. But and I grew up between US, UK, and India. My family's from India, but I was born in UK initially. was in US and then moved back to India. So from really 5 years old to 24, I was in India. So in many ways, I'm very in, like my daily existence is very Indian. But obviously I live in the US now, I have a wife and two boys. And so, so it's a mix.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, a truly global citizen, Rafat. I mean, the move, like you said, from computer science, from a computer thing to journalism, normally, like you said, it's journalism today, is something that, I mean, it's I see you tweeting about it in terms of especially media companies and all. But again, yeah. I'll leave that aside, not like the weather.
Yeah, that's a whole different conversation we'll have at some point in the state of media today.
Absolutely. And but one thing, you know, when I see and I go in and I look for really good news about the industry in general, travel industrial, I see Skift, you know, coming up all over the place, you know, and you can't miss it. You can't actually miss it. And you sort of, you know, it's reliable information, you know, it makes sense. So I think, you know, hats off to you and the team for what you've built in a noisy world, because there's a lot of noise. But how much of that is actually accurate or correct, right, is where the question is.
Yeah.
And I must say, Rafa, that it's not only I admire Skift as a media in travel, but I also admire your posts on LinkedIn. I think for myself, I want to be like Rafa sometimes when I do my posts, because basically what you do, your posts are very often very short, but so powerful. Like, you know, it's really just sometimes few sentences or one paragraph, but straight to the point. They make you think, they show the issue, they raise right questions. So I just wanted to say, like, whoever is not following Rafat, you're missing out. You should follow him on LinkedIn.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah,
I mean, Twitter or X, sorry, X.
Actually, yeah, we have David, you and I can sidebar on my Twitter personality versus my LinkedIn personality.
But exactly, I think it's completely, you know.
It's very different. I'm more political on Twitter, and obviously LinkedIn is very, very business. Even though, as you said, Alex, I write, you know, what I think. It's been, as a journalist, as a former journalist, now running a business media company. I still have the love for writing, so that's always there. And two, I think my role and my previous company was the similar boat, and Skift is that we are the bullshit detectors of the industry, if you will. And sometimes as you grow as a company, you sort of lose some of that as you grow. And I'm sure we have lost and gained various things over the years, but I want to make sure that we don't lose that edge, of saying things as we see it. And obviously for the rest of the company in our, they take cues from me, and I want to make sure that they understand that that's our role, is to, I use this phrase, my job is to periodically poke the industry, and always be friendly, never be friends. That's also a philosophy that journalists have. Like, you can be friendly with sources, but you cannot be friends, because you need to be an outsider looking in. That's our role. It's hard now because we've sort of become insider in the industry, but we still want to have that mentality of we're outsiders looking in versus us becoming the insiders ourselves. So anyway.
I think that's such a powerful statement as well, Rafat, when you look at it that way, you know, being friendly versus being friends. And I think it's always good that you have this outside view of the industry, because sometimes I'm sure Alex has been in the industry for quite a few years. We normally tend to think in our silos. We've always done things this way, and this is the way that things have always happened. But, you know, COVID was a good wake-up call to actually sort of, you know, we all got shook up, and you know, things just disappeared over a, you know, over just a matter of a few weeks, that, you know, we went from growth, where are all the people? You know, people simply disappeared. Whether you talk about airlines, hotels, airports, anything, people simply disappeared. So that was a good wake-up call.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're probably back in the growth phase at this point. But obviously, a lot of new types of growth coming, which I guess is what we're going to talk about on this podcast.
Absolutely. Alex, you have anything to add?
No, let's get it going.
So the purpose of this is to focus on a particular country. I mean, I thought it'll make it more focused. And with Rafat's permission, I was thinking of a title for the podcast, and I talked about Shifting India. But then I thought a better title would be Skifting India. because because if I did a little research on the word skift and how you came up with Rafa, but if you want to just tell our listeners about what is skift actually.
Well, skift means shift in Scandinavian languages, in Norwegian, in I think a few other Scandinavian languages as well. So it's sort of apropos from that perspective. Shift as in we are covering as a company the shift or transformation happening in the travel industry. So that's what we say.
Absolutely. So I think with your permission, and of course, Skift is trademarked, but Skifting India is what the title would be. And I think it's apt for India because, you know, when you try to move a country of 1.4 billion people, it's never an easy job.
Yeah.
And even though we may talk about statistics about how few Indians actually as a percentage travel, but still whatever percentage that travel is a huge percentage.
It's a big,
and that
big
comes,
number.
Yeah, it's a big number, right? And of course, you've got two elements. You've got domestic and you've got the international side of the business. And India has always wanted to be a superpower. I think, you know, it's always considered itself, you know, we're the largest democracy in the world. We're the largest population now in the world. Mm-hmm. But the question is, as a travel superpower, India has always sort of lagged behind. You know, when you look at either airlines or aircraft fleet, you know, even if you look at wide body, I think India had a fleet of less than 50 wide body aircraft for a huge country, of course. That's changing now. But coming to the question is, we've got a younger, richer India. And we heard that story, two questions actually, that Indians are not easy travelers. They're pretty picky and pretty, I would call it social media savvy. You know, I've heard of things when a flight is delayed, they're busy taking videos and saying, I'm going to complain about you. Mm-hmm. But the question is also in terms of luxury, you know, Indians want to splurge, Indians spend. I mean, what is your sense of this new sort of Indian traveler?
Yeah, so for us at Skift, we're covering India very closely now for the last few years. India had a milestone moment. I'm going to say early last year, it was 2023, where India became the most populous country in the world, surpassing China, which historically was looked upon as sort of a negative thing. But now, as the world has changed, as the fertility rates and generally demographic changes happening in the world, where in the West and many countries in Asia are going through a crisis of not having enough people or coming into that crisis, this seems to be India's strength, at least for the next 50, 60, 70, 80 years, of like having enough people in the age category that are coming into workforce that is driving the next phase of growth for India. So from a GDP perspective, obviously the numbers are there. You've seen it's the world's fastest growing country globally at the size it's at, 7 to 8 to 9% GDP growth per year, which is just mind-bogglingly fast happening. Lots of infrastructure. So since you're from India, David, you know this, and I'm from India there too. The infrastructure was always the biggest issue. Like, things don't exist, or if they exist, they're in a state of disrepair, or if they do get built, they get broken pretty quickly. Roads, bridges, all the stuff. Airports until the Delhi T3, is it? The T2, I forget what the terminal number
is. Yeah, I keep forgetting.
Yeah, so it's the main terminal that you fly into if you're flying international long haul. That came into existence and gave Indians really a sense of what global airports look like in India. And so Mumbai changed, and then obviously there's so many new airports. One stat we heard at our Skift India Summit that we did last month in India, our first conference there, was that there's a new airport being handed over to the public or being completed every 6 days.
Wow.
This was the ambassador, the US ambassador to India, I interviewed him on stage. I think he said that, which I need to verify. That seems incredible. So a lot of new infrastructure coming in. The growth of the middle class, everybody knows this, but travel as an aspiration, as in once you cross a certain level of GDP, travel becomes an aspiration for the people that are getting into middle class and above. And that's been true across all countries historically as people go through the transition of economies growing and people coming into more money. And so that's happened in India. What happened during COVID and I think this is still underreported, is how much travel, domestic travel, came into its own in India. You know, when you and I were growing up in India, for us, travel was going to our grandmother or grandfather on both sides. Like that was summer. Correct. And we stayed with them for, and if you're a little richer, you would go to like the hill stations, what they call the hill stations. Or if you really were rich, you would go to Dubai or maybe London, etc. There's a different class of people. But the majority holiday wasn't an aspiration. Travel wasn't an aspiration. And so now that has been unleashed for all the reasons you know, globalization, internet, digital, young people working and understand at these giant multinational companies that are in India too, that unleashes a different level of consumerism. So consumerism as a culture really started in India in the 90s and has since obviously grown. So all of those are macro things that are affecting travel industry. And honestly, if you go to India now, if you talk to the local travel players, they don't really care about inbound international. The global players that are there, so like Marriott, so Hilton's, etc., they want international tourists to come because obviously the ADRs that they charge, this is the room rates that they charge, are much higher for international than
correct
domestic. But like they're saying, we don't need anybody to come to, like we would love to, but the point is that the industry, which is booming in India, is purely a result of the domestic tourism. International isn't that much, honestly, and that's a whole different thing we can talk about, why international inbound into India should be one of the most visited countries on the planet. It's not a priority for the government. There's no marketing muscle behind it. There's many perceptions, many of them reality about safety, etc., coming to India, particularly women. So that was a big point of discussion at our conference that I mentioned, Skift India Summit last month. But the action is all domestic, much like China. Obviously, China huge in terms of domestic. China, the recovery of China post COVID. Outbound hasn't come back as much as people would have expected. It's true for the places you're based in. Dubai hasn't seen as many Chinese tourists. Correct. Europe hasn't seen as many Chinese tourists as was expected. Many reasons, including the geopolitics of it. So Indians are emerging. It may not replace Chinese. I don't think they will. But as another big force from outbound perspective. And As you mentioned before, and this is true, it's still a very small percent of the overall Indians that are able to afford to travel. I think it's like 1% or something.
Correct, about that much, yeah.
And so, but 1% of a billion, what's the population? A billion, 4 billion, 5, 7?
I get 1.4, yeah, it's 1.5, almost 1.4. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a lot of people, 150 million people right there. And so being able to travel outside. And, the place where you're based, David, Dubai has figured it out so well. Like literally Dubai is built on the backs of Indian labor. Correct. And Indian tourists.
Absolutely.
And now it's obviously a global hub and all types of people come. But so that's the India story today.
No, thank you, Rafa. It's a good insight to actually get into, you know, India. Like you said, domestic is really big in India, and you know, India is not too worried about getting international tourism. Like you pointed out, the budgets actually were slashed for Incredible India. I think this was this year, so they sort of came down to something that is not even equal to one day's, you know, proper advertising in sense. So the focus of India is
probably Dubai. You spend more money in a single day promoting Dubai than India does for the whole year.
Absolutely. That was spot on as well. Alex?
Yeah, I think you already touched on a few trends. Looking at the summit that you've done recently and at the Skift research, what do you think are emerging trends in India travel industry, and maybe how they compare to global trends in travel industry? Is there something that is uniquely exclusive to Indian travel industry? Would be keen to hear your opinion on that.
Yeah. So just from a traveler behavior perspective, let's focus on that, because obviously traveler behavior is the most important part to understand. Indians are not monoliths. This is true for any country. They're not a single entity that travel a single way. But some cliches are there for a reason. Indians historically have loved when they travel. David, you and I were talking about this, are very picky travelers. We like to complain a lot as a society. The interesting part is before, when India was a socialist country, we didn't have avenues to complain. Now with the digital, this is why if you look at how Indians in general, again, this is a very generic statement, behave online. If you look at comments in Indian forums or comments from Indians on global forums, they're probably the most vitriolic, because this, and my theory on this is that historically India didn't have an avenue to express themselves. When it came so fast that they didn't have a sense of how to moderate and have an evolution into civil discourse. And so civil discourse on the web, coming from Indians, is probably the most vitriolic around the world. Enough research has to be done on it for it to be verified beyond my anecdotal understanding, but I've been in the digital sphere for a long time, so I have a good sense of it. That translates a little bit into the travel industry, where in general, Indians, when they travel, they want Indian food or things Indian way, etc. That's been historically been the case. That is changing. It's also true for Chinese travelers, by the way, where there are a bunch of cliches about their traveling groups, and they only want, you know, your hotel has to be China ready and all the stuff that you remember from like 10 years ago. That is changing because, again, Indians are very globally savvy. They tools like Google Maps basically lays it out for you. You just have to search in Google Map and it'll tell you what to do, where to eat, et cetera, et cetera. So bunch of that is changing. Indians do still travel in groups a lot more than some of the other countries, family, multi-generational, et cetera. If you look at Southeast Asia's rise as an India hub for attracting Indian tourists, back when I was growing up, Malaysia, et cetera, were never on our map for honeymoon destinations. Honeymoon was local in India. And even that was pretty tame of like hill stations and Shimla, et cetera. Now, you look at my brother who got married in 2018, went to Kuala Lumpur for his honeymoon. Again, not a thing that would have existed 15, 20 years before that. So that's happening on the honeymoon side. A lot is the first entree for many, many couples to start traveling. The sophistication of Indian travelers is changing. The people that are in the luxury, ultra luxury category are really, really rich in India and are able to spend as much or even more than as any other type of traveler. They demand a lot out of, you know, whether it's on the flights. You know, there's many stories of like how hard it is to manage a plane full of Indian travelers. So they do demand a lot. And both from airlines as well as hotels when they go into that. And so there's a little bit of that too. I can keep on talking, but and also one of the other things that happens, like if, for instance, there's a lot of first-time travelers. You can imagine it's a country where so many people are traveling outside of India for the first time. In terms of how the evolution happens, like if Indians are going to Europe for the first time, guarantee they're going to touch 5 different countries in 5 days versus us as sophisticated travelers from this part of the world or us generally sophisticated travelers will go to a country, find deep immersion. But Indians will go to Switzerland, take photos from where all the Bollywood movies were filmed and will go to Germany and Austria and et cetera, et cetera. So they'll touch all the highlights. So there's a lot of country hopping that happens. And that's why Schengen visa, et cetera, they matter a lot for Indian travelers because then they're able to do the highlights and then document for social media, et cetera. So yes, and then also social media, it's very, between Instagram, TikTok is banned in India, but Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and of course WhatsApp as well, the travels are very heavily documented.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to add to your point, and I will not quote the airline names, there was a friend of mine, actually an ex-colleague. So he used to work for a European airline. And then, of course, he's moved to an Indian carrier recently. And he said, David, my stress levels are way up in terms of, you know, managing passengers because, you know, anything goes wrong, flights are delayed, whatever. He says, you know, Indian passengers are really, really, you know, super savvy about complaining, about taking pictures, about videos and all. So I said, don't worry, you're going to get there. You'll improve with time. He said, yeah. He said, yeah, but really, it's a different experience, completely different experience. Because a lot of them are first-time travelers as well, and they don't understand that an aircraft is on the ground. There's a technical issue. It's going to take a few sort of, you know, it's going to take some time till you actually sort out what it is. So I guess we will learn. You know, Indians have always been travelers, and I think we find Indians in all parts of the world. I remember once I was in the middle of the rainforest in the Amazon and a place called Manaus, and our guide, I was expecting a Brazilian guide, obviously. That's what you'll expect. Ask him, where are you from? No, I'm from Pune in Maharashtra. I said, how did you get to the middle of the rainforest? He said, oh, that's a long story. But we have always been travelers as Indians. But I think, you know, it's the new generation. It's a new change that's happening in terms of, you know, where we travel to. Like you said, a lot of destinations. I'm not one for sun and sand. I mean, I don't need a tan or whatever in terms of a beach destination. But I think Indians are also going for a lot of destinations, like you said, that we've never done before as well.
Yeah, sun and sand wasn't a concept in India, as you know, until I guess now. But I still don't think it's a huge thing. But like if you go to Bali, you'll find a lot of Indian tourists, particularly obviously the upper class tourists and that are there in Bali. For instance, so Bali has become aspirational as well, kind of like it happened in the West a while ago. India started a few years ago.
Absolutely.
It's really funny how when you describe those different specific travel behaviors, few real life examples just popped in my mind, but I never thought about it. So you said that Indian travelers are very demanding. I remember traveling with an ex-colleague on Swiss Airlines in economy. And he demanded mango juice, and he was very disappointed that mango juice was not available there. And the second example that I could remember was Aviation Festival in Lisbon last year. CEO of one big company, he lives in the US, but he is Indian. He organized a dinner, and he invited everyone to the best Indian restaurant in Lisbon. And we were wondering, why not local food? We were craving the local food and fish, but he really wanted us to taste the India. So
yeah.
I think all the things that you talk about, they are actually real, like, we could see it every day.
It's happening just, as well.
We don't think about it so much. Yeah.
Now the Indians that are more sophisticated do like local food, but you will always see if, let's say, it's a 5-day trip that they're going to. I'm going to make it up. Iceland. They will in one of those days make sure that they do get the Indian food as part of their thing. It happens to me personally. This is what I do. It's like, I'm going to go anywhere where there's nothing, no Indian food, but somehow I'll find that one Indian restaurant for that one meal just to say I did get my own cuisine one of the days. There's another anecdote on the flight thing. If in a flight you see a lot of people ordering tomato juice, you can guarantee that a lot of Indians are on that flight because Indians love tomato soup. They love tomatoes juice as well, especially the spicy one.
I attest to that, Rafa, because, you know, for me, I've, of course, moved over to ginger ale now. But in the earlier days, it was tomato juice. And I remember this on a Jet Airways flight. I asked him, I want tomato juice. And he says, sorry, we're out of stock. I said, what do you mean? The guy who ordered the Bloody Mary, you're giving him the juice, you know, with whatever. But I just want the juice. How come you told me there's nothing, you know, left? And then, of course, he gave it to me. So I can attest to the tomato juice. But
yeah, Indians love tomato juice.
Yeah, I've gone to ginger ale, so that's a separate story again. But also another thing which you talked about, Alex, is the mangoes. Foreigners will never understand the taste of a good mango. You know, what people get in a lot of different countries is not the real taste of what an Indian mango is. You know, it's a difference.
It's hard to describe the obsession Indian mangoes. You can tell, you can write stories, you can see videos, but Indian obsession with mangoes is something you cannot understand unless you're in India and can see it. Okay, we're off the path, but let's get back on.
But Alex, so you know, just going back to one trend which sort of you reminded me in the report is about the big fat Indian weddings, mm-hmm. and of course you talked about honeymoons. You talked about the honeymooners, but I think if you could take us a little bit through this huge industry that has been created in India about the big Indian weddings. Mm-hmm. The amount that's being spent and a little bit of a sense of the size of that industry, because it links the airlines, it links hotels, it links everything right around the place in terms of a gap. So if you can just give us a little bit on that.
Yeah, if you go to research.skift.com, the latest report, and I'm just reading it, Tying the Knot Abroad, Market Sizing Indian Wedding Tourism. So this is our latest report that our team, our research team came out with, Varsha and Robin and others in our team. So so this was specifically about Indian weddings outside of India. So the more richer Indians that are going to different destinations to destination weddings across whether it's Asia or Europe or even US, etc. So so that was a 1.5-1.6 billion market that we market sized at. And obviously many, many, many hundreds of times more exists in India itself, the wedding market. I don't know if you call it wedding tourism per se, because that's just, it happens if my brother got married, he got married in the hometowns. So I don't know if that's, there's benefits to the travel industry as a result of it, people staying in hotels and using other services, etc. And obviously destination weddings happen in India, as in people getting married in different places in India outside of their places where they live as well. So that is a huge market. If you talk to any international hotel operator in India, like Marriott or Hyatt or anybody, they will say their business is built on weddings happening at their hotels. That's it. Like that's the biggest factor. And obviously wedding seasons happen, so there's a seasonality to it in India. But a huge part of the group, which they wouldn't admit to in any other part of the world. Like in other parts of the world, it's in US, for instance, or even Europe and stuff, corporate travelers continue to be a big part of a group travel, which is business travel itself. It's a big part of how companies charge, of these hotels to charge higher rates or whatever else. So, but in India, the script is totally flipped. It's not the corporate traveler that makes the margins, it's the weddings that make the margins at these hotels. Internationally, obviously, this is the research report on how many destinations have historically, Dubai is one of them. Interestingly, from your part of the world, David, Ras Al Khaimah has emerged as an interesting destination that, because it's not as developed, it's a little bit more natural scenery and et cetera, has developed a reputation of a upper class Indian wedding destination that people come to. And Indian weddings are not like a single day affair, you know this. So it's a multi-day affair, sometimes even a multi-week affair that happens. And so the tourism dollars are stretched over a longer period of time. Typically, Indian weddings are bigger in terms of number of people. 500 in India, 500-person wedding would be called a small wedding. And so that was my brother's wedding when my mom said, oh, it's a small wedding. How many people? 500 people. I said, like, how is that a small wedding? But that's in India would be a small wedding. The fun part, like when you send a card to somebody to come to an Indian wedding, you say, Rafat Ali and family. So and family could be anybody in the family that is visiting you or your cousins coming. And so there's no estimate, unlike in Western countries where you do a per plate charge. And so you have to have a strict kind of how many people are coming in India. That's not a concept. It may be changing now, but so Indian weddings in general have become a huge thing. And as you said, David, it requires plane capacity. It requires transportation. It requires obviously wedding planners, et cetera, but catering and obviously the accommodation itself. Event planners, all these things. So So that's become such a huge part and will continue to grow because, again, the youth, there's still a lot of youth coming into, a lot of young people coming into youth. And then obviously that's the marriage age in India. And I guess this is a life thought that I had not thought of. Historically, Indians didn't, divorce was a taboo. And now so Indians are remarrying and a lot more than historically Indians ever remarried. So it's like we get two bites of the apple from a tourism perspective. So they're not just getting married once, but twice. They may not be getting married the second time with the same amount of festivities as the first time, but at least there's something there. This is Indian, so they'll have some festivity somewhere.
Yeah, I never thought of that, you know, in terms of the divorce rates going up, you know, your actual, the amount of times, you know, you marry in a lifetime also goes up. But again, it's a different issue about how brand you want it to be. But I guess, you know, with credit cards and travel products that people will offer, you know, you could have a wedding credit line of whatever you want to call it.
Oh, I'm sure it exists. I don't know this for sure, but I'm sure there's a wedding line of credit that banks offer. Yeah, I mean, it's also unfortunate because there's so much money spent on weddings and people go in debt and even the poor people, people who are not that economically strong, unfortunately, and the pressure to put more, you know, put on these weddings. But that's a different social issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just attest that, you know, just Alex would like to invite you to, and maybe Rafat as well, to a Hyderabadi wedding as well, because, you know, obviously when you have the biryani and the sweet and all that, you forget all your worries and for the next few days. And, you know, so the Hyderabadi weddings are, I mean, of course, Lucknow is also, I mean, would be difficult to compete with definitely. You guys.
Yes.
But still, you know, for me, Hyderabad and wedding is an experience.
Yeah, definitely.
Still haven't been to any single Indian wedding. That's something that I missed out somehow.
Well, David, you know what to do next, so.
Absolutely, absolutely, you know.
No, but Rafat, I want to ask you about something that is a really big topic in Europe, the region that where I'm based, but I'm curious, how is it in India? Sustainability. Everyone talks about sustainability here. Yeah. We're talking about 2030, 2050, 20 something. Sustainable flights and offsets and everything. This is affecting industry so much to an extent where, you know, this term greenwashing started to exist and actually airlines being called on this. How is it in India? What is your take on it?
Yeah. So my general take on sustainability and travel and the talk about it is probably what I would say for India as well. There's a lot of talk and performative things that happen in India, particularly this is very true in India. Like government will institute the rules, people will loudly follow it, but underneath you'll see nothing is really happening. And so like, for instance, plastic ban. In India, they're plastic bags banned. But if you go to any Indian city, anywhere, any rural place, like you'll see so much plastic waste everywhere. So a lot of it is performative. This is true for everything in India, but also particularly true for the travel industry as well. I think there's awareness, like the cliches of young people being more aware are true in India too. That's 100% true. But in general, the Indian stance, this also, by the way, comes out at things like COP20, COP26, COP27, COP20, the climate summits that happen every year, which is countries like India and others are saying to the West that you destroyed the world. And now when it's our turn, you're saying us not, you're telling us not to do the things that we need to do to lift our societies and economies out of poverty into middle class and beyond, to which they have a valid point. Like we will consume, we still only emit X% of the world's carbon, if you will. And so now you can't tell us how to live our lives, and they're asking all the stuff that you know very well. So I think the pressures that are there in Europe, particularly where you are, Alex, aren't there in India. Unless, David, you know of specific instances of like, I'm sure there's carbon neutral targets that, for instance, Air India and Indigo have.
Correct.
Yes, I'm talking airlines.
Yeah.
There's just general inbuilt practices in Indian society about reusing a lot of material. This is true for historically in India. And so you can see how if those traditions get readopted or continue to get adopted in the hospitality industry, for example, that India is better positioned at scale to be able to be more sustainable. I would say that's sort of the sentiment that we have. We did this conference last month at the Leela Hotels and Resorts, the Leela Palace opening event was in Delhi, and the actual conference was in Gurgaon. And the food that was set up, the food stations that were set up, they were very particular about reusing every part of, for instance, an orange that they're the actual orange is used for this and this, and the and the skin is used as a container for other types of dessert, and so things like that I think are very interesting. I just don't know if there's enough happening at scale for it to have a significant impact on carbon footprint. And I just think that this is the challenge with travel in general when we have this talk about conversation about sustainability. Like as a construct, travel is extractive. Like that won't change. If you don't want travel to be extractive, stop traveling. Like that's the 100% solution to it. But that won't happen.
Correct.
And so I think regulation is important, but the reality is like you have to the culprits are many of the industries, and travel is only one much smaller part of it than other industries are. That's my general view.
I think, Robert, just to add to that, like you mentioned about Indian traditions, a lot of Indian traditions were sustainable. You know, they took into account nature, they took into account reuse of things as well.
Right.
So
we didn't have enough disposable things. People used it because that's what we had.
That's what we had, correct. And even if you look at clothes and fashion, I remember as kids, you know, each time we got a new set of clothes was either for a festival, maybe once in a year or whatever like that. So now India has sort of adopted the Western mindset where you talk about fast fashion and
use and throw,
which I just hope that sometimes, you know, we will go back to our roots. But I think, like you also said, a lot of the young Indian youth that are there are aware of things. They want to change things. They want to go back to where things are. But I think it's because of the sheer size of India, it sometimes becomes difficult to manage. But I think I would sort of throw it into the question to the listeners as well. Sometimes India manages itself as a country. If you go to a Western country, you see, you know, all these school marshals sort of marshaling traffic during school because you don't want the kids to get injured and hurt and stuff like that. But when you go to an Indian school, you find the kids all over the place on the road with auto rickshaws and cars and everyone, and still everyone is safe. So I think India will find its way thanks to the sheer size of the population, because they use a word called jugaad in India, right? We find our own way of doing things.
Yeah.
I think even for sustainability, Indians will find a way to sort of manage. But I think it's like you said, it's going to be the small things and not the big sort of, you know, media.
Yeah,
stuff.
I mean, regulations versus local solutions. I think, Alex, that's a good point, which is will regulations work or local solutions work? And I guess it can be either or. But in India, there's a good chance that if the local solutions are there, which are basically local traditions coming up, that has a much bigger impact than, because in India, regulations come and enforcement doesn't come. And so, and the legal mechanisms aren't there, or if they are, they're not implemented again on this stuff. So that's a challenge in India quite a bit.
What are your views, Rafat, about airlines in India? I mean, of course, you know, we've talked about
incredible growth.
Yeah. If you look at, and you, especially your recent interview that you had with the CEO of Air India, right? Campbell Wilson.
Yeah, Campbell. Yeah.
Yeah. What are your sort of maybe a quick summary of what you think?
Yeah, it's the fastest growing market in the world, fastest growing aviation market, the largest really at this point. There's, again, I think that it was the US ambassador that said, somebody said on stage that IndiGo will probably become the world's largest airline in the coming future. And the planes that they have in order, which whenever they get delivered. But IndiGo is what, 60% of the market. 60% from, you know, IndiGo was not a name that existed whenever it started, 15 years ago?
15 years ago, 15, yeah.
And so, at 60% of the market, Air India owned 100% of the market, as you know, until 20 years ago, maybe a little more than that at this point. So it's an incredible thing. And so obviously now Air India wants to claw back that number from Indigo and others that are there. Casa is emerging quite fast, as I think they have double-digit market share now in India as well. So the action is still, again, on domestic because airports are growing, people are traveling. There's just a lot of demand for domestic airline travel. The lounges are absolutely choke full. If you think lounges in the West are full, you need to go to India to see. So they've and the credit cards there, because credit card is a new phenomena in India, relatively new phenomena. There's a lot of competition, just cutthroat competition on the credit card side. And to entice people, if you think credit cards have become are one of the reasons why the lounges are filled in the West, because they give incentives for people to do. You have to go to India to see it. I was in Delhi when I was coming back, and I forget what lounge, the name of the lounge. This was Etihad I was flying. And I went to the wrong lounge because Etihad, it's the same lounge. There are two different lounges, one for credit card people and one for actual passengers that are flying. I went to the credit card lounge.
Oh.
And I was standing in the line for half an hour. I went to the counter and says, "Why are you here? The actual lounge for actual paying travelers is there." I said, "Oh, I just wasted half an hour." And I could see just the amount, like they had to verify everybody that they had the right credit card and that to do some transaction, et cetera, whatever. Point is that the demand for air travel today is even more than the supplies there in India. So that's where tons of the action is. On the long haul side, with these planes coming in, obviously, if you look at the Gulf airlines, the three big ones, Emirates, Etihad, and Qatar, the not-so-secret is they're built on the backs of Indians transiting through these hubs. From any class, by the way, not just the economy, sure, but also front of the bus. And if you're here in the U.S. and JFK, if you're coming to Delhi, like Etihad when I fly, or Emirates when I fly, Qatar when I fly, the majority of the people are Indians on the plane. And so Air India is saying that why shouldn't that be our traffic? Like if you're taking Indians from India to everywhere else in the world, that should be our traffic. So the big battle to come, still early, is Indian Airlines, as in Air India, Indigo, and others, versus these Gulf airlines. That's the biggest battle to come in the next 5 to 10 years. Again, will be fascinating to see. As a consumer, I'm looking forward to it on the pricing part.
Yep, absolutely.
Because a lot of new incentives will come. Obviously, Indian airlines are not there from a standard perspective today. If I have a choice today, which is a choice that I made to come to India for our conference to Delhi, it was a choice between a direct flight from Air India versus a stopover in any of the Middle East airlines. And I chose the Middle East airlines.
Let me guess. Yeah.
Yes. And so Air India today on the Delhi route is terrible. I hear Mumbai is much better, especially in the business class, but it's still not there. Any of the Middle East airlines, any day I'll take. And obviously the airports are a lot better on the stopover too. The new Abu Dhabi one, I stopped at the new Abu Dhabi airport, which is incredible.
I was going to ask you about Rafat, because I saw the picture and I said, okay. Did you like it?
Oh, it was incredible. Yeah, I mean, I would say even because it's brand new, it felt even better than DXP. And the lounge, the Etihad lounge, is like 3-level lounge and all types of food. And it was Ramadan going on, so they had all types of food and everything else for that too. It's incredible. The shops there are and the design, etc., looks really, really good. Finally, Abu Dhabi has.
Finally, because that was one thing that we always had a challenge with. The old airport was built, way back, and it was built for maybe 5 million passengers. Then it went to 10 million. Then it went to 22 million. And of course, not enough. So the new midfield is finally something that turned Abu Dhabi around. And I'm really happy for Abu Dhabi, not because I'm in Abu Dhabi, is because now there's finally a focus on the entire tourism sort of picture. And I think just last week, there was this announcement of $10 billion.
$10 billion investment. Yeah, they're back. Yeah. Abu Dhabi did a lot of investment initially, obviously, the Louvre and the museums and the culture that they've built. And then Etihad obviously came out of the gate and James Hogan expanded everywhere and then contracted. It looks like their ambition now is to be back, maybe not competing the same level as Emirates is, but back into ordering new planes and building more routes, etc. Obviously on the backs of the new airport as well.
Correct. And it's one of the few airports in the world where you'll find that you've got three airline using it as a hub airport. And out of those three, two are low-cost carriers. So you've got this beautiful terminal. And you've got the low-cost carriers operating into this beautiful terminal, which is unlike what you would see in, say, Europe, where low-cost would operate into, you know, the secondary sort of terminals. Yeah. But so it's strange, right? You fly in a low-cost airline, but you arrive into a beautiful terminal, but you know, you're saving on your flights. So great, you know, have the same sort of experience that you would fly on a normal premium carrier.
Yeah.
Good.
Personally, I'm very excited about development of Air India to see how it's going to be. What I see currently on a few planes, on the new cabin layouts and designs and services of hard and soft product is great. But then once they roll it out across entire fleet and get more planes, I'm really curious exactly to see how they will compete in this battle, as you called it, with Middle Eastern airlines. So
yeah,
this
I think
is something.
A lot of the competition will be on the soft side in Indian carriers. Like the more quote unquote Indian you can be for Indians traveling, the more Indians will want. If the hard product at the end of the day can be as good as the Middle East carriers, which will take time, by the way, it won't come fast. It won't come easy. Being able to customize. I mean, if I can get samosas on the flight. And the mango juice on the flight. And if the hard product is the same, I'm going to take an Indian airline. And if it's a direct flight, I think that we cannot discount that part, which is a 14-hour direct flight from JFK to Delhi versus at least 17 to 18 hours, if not more, stopover. For now, we choose the extra time because of all the reasons we talked about. But the direct flights will matter a lot from London, particularly as well, because there's so much traffic between those two countries. It'll be fascinating on the soft side. The service levels aren't there yet, particularly in the upper class in Indian Airlines. You could argue Indians have a lot of hospitality, and that's true, et cetera, but the consistency of standard levels of service, the professionalism isn't there yet. Tata, as the owner of Indian Airlines and Vistara and others, Vistara did a good job, and they continue to do a good job. I think that hopefully that and more is the standard of operation that comes in. Operationally, the airports are running a lot better now because just the on-time departures, etc. They're very, very. There's a lot of improvements happening in India on that front because the new infrastructure coming in. So that will also help in terms of punctuality and operation-wise as well.
Grafat, I'm conscious of time as well. Alex, do you have anything else that you want to quiz Rafat on?
No, probably the closing. No. I think it was a great conversation. So many insights. Thank you very much. I think the last question that I would want to ask, I said that I'm really looking forward to see how Air India will develop with the new products. Is there something that you are really looking for as in the development in India travel and aviation industry? Maybe not like as an industry expert, you know, but as a person who was born there, as an Indian person.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this direct flights. I'll take direct flights to cut my time to travel to India. Certainly that a lot of Indians, if you talk, that would be a huge advantage. Direct flights that work and are at the same level as other airlines as well. The interesting part in India is that a lot of these international chains as well as local Indian chains are coming into what is called like B-class cities, meaning outside of the big cities. And so if the town where my family lives in India, this town called Aligarh, which is south of Delhi, 3 hours out of Delhi, didn't really have any standard international standard hotel. Any class, mid-class, upper class, upper, you know, luxury, etc. Luxury isn't there. But now, you know, 2 years ago when I was landed and driving to Aligarh, I saw like a Ramada Inn. I said, oh, Ramada is here now. Which again is not like a upper class hotel or anything like that, but at least there's Ramada now. And others are coming as well. Some of the local chains, Lemon Tree has now a hotel in India as well. Lemon Tree is a local chain. So I'm excited about better hotels, better international standard hotels coming into smaller towns in India. That's where if you talk to any hotel operator, they'll say like, that's where the growth is in India. And there's a lot of growth left. So that I'm excited about as well. And just ease of transport, better roads, like David can attest, just better roads. I don't know if it can teach Indians better how to drive better in traffic. That's a different, whole different conversation. But also public transport. I mean, the fact that the trains have the subway systems in India have come, the Delhi Metro, Bombay, etc., have come, and even in smaller cities, Hyderabad and others are coming. I think that's, David, tell me if that's true or not. But local transport, which as you can imagine is a huge issue in India, huge. And so ease of traveling. And then the last thing I'll say is like safety remains a huge issue in India, huge issue. And it doesn't get talked about enough. And this is, I'm not just talking domestic tourists. Well, it's even there for domestic tourists. But even certainly international tourists, the reason they could do as much promotion as they want if the budgets are there. But if the safety of tourists isn't there, there was a case when we were there in India last month of a very unfortunate case of a Spanish female tourist being gang raped. And that was in news when we were in the country. And so, again, these perceptions are reality. So that has to be solved for India. There has to be a more concerted effort, but it's unfortunately not divorced from the daily living experience in India. So unless a societal change happens. So anyway, that's, I don't want to end on that dour note, but that is a real issue in India. And barring that one big issue, a lot of other things are aligning very well for the Indian travel industry market, Indian traveler.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rafat, and really appreciate the insights. And of course, you have a bird's eye view of India, but also I know India has a special place in your heart as well.
True.
Because India is about family as well. And, you know, just to end it on a nice note, I really liked your post about mom attending your very first conference. So even though you started out from a technology perspective as a journalist, but, you know, that's maybe one reason I think you like conferences, because it's the human-to-human interaction. Human
connection, correct, yeah.
And especially when you have family there. But were you a little bit anxious? What is mom going to say?
Yeah, it was a very nerve-wracking experience. I've never... So I speak Hindi, Urdu at home, the language that I'm sure you also speak, or any other regional languages in India. But and I've never spoken English in front of my mom, like in a professional setting. She's heard me speak on the phone, etc. So it's not just my mom, it's my sisters, my brother, my cousins, my nephews, my nieces. Like there was a Rafat section at Skift India Summit. I mean, unofficial section. They were sitting at the back. My mom was only supposed to be there for 2 hours, but she said, no, I'm going to listen to everything Rafat says on stage, because she was so like full of pride. So this was the first, and my dad passed away in 2019, so I wish he was there. But it was a great, and only in India can you mix this thing. Like in the West, they would have said, like, what are you doing? You're bringing your family to a conference. So it was a great experience from that perspective. And the thing I told her is don't expect this every year. This was a year one-time hall pass, because then it becomes too much of like mixing personal with professional. But it was great. She still keeps talking about it every day.
Next time you should host an Indian wedding at your forum.
Exactly. Well, so you think, so it's not a joke. many people, really? By the way, yeah. So many said, you should do a side tour, people coming to India for India Summit, of people who can attend an Indian wedding. So we'll have to start a side business on that.
Oh my God. I mean, and on that note, thank you so much, Rafat, because I think India is a country that you actually, for all those who haven't been there, it's time you get over there to India. And it's a huge country. We've got a very deep heart and we're very hospitable people. So please feel free to visit India whenever you can. Thank you so much.